Welcome to another episode of The Breakdown. Today we're going to have us a little bit of a heavier conversation because there's an issue that came to a little bit more of the spotlight over the last couple of weeks with the cold snap that we had in Alberta. But that does not mean by any stretch of the imagination that this issue is new. This issue that we're going to talk about has been around for quite a long time. It's a problem that Alberta and Canada have been aware of for a very long time, and it's a problem that we haven't done a very good job of addressing. What I'm talking about is the problem of homelessness. And to have this conversation, we're very, very grateful to be joined by Dr. Cynthia Pudu, who is a PhD out of McEwen University, who specializes in not just studying the causes of homelessness, but particularly in studying youth homelessness. So Dr. Pudu, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So it's a huge topic to try to even start to unpack. But so before we do that, let's start with just a basic introduction for our audience who may not be aware of who you are, who you are, or your history, your academic history. So to start with, who is Dr. Cynthia Pudu?
I am an assistant professor at Grant McEwen University, and I also work in the research office as the director of Community Engaged Scholarship. And Community Engaged Scholarship is a type of research where people work really closely with the community. You kind of get embedded with the community to get an understanding of what community issues are or issues of different organizations. And you use your expertise as a researcher to try and address those issues or shine a light on those issues. And so through doing that work, I was closely connected with in Edmonton Boyle Street Community Services, which is right across the street from the Rogers Place Arena. And I spent a lot of time there and before the arena had broken ground, so in around 2014 or so, or maybe a little bit before that. And there was a lot of concern about what was happening with that new arena redevelopment and how it might impact all the community members that were experiencing homelessness or houseless. And I was specifically working with the youth unit there. And so we just started having a conversation to try and get an understanding of, is there going to be displacement? What's going to be the impact? Policing was a concern. Would there be more policing because of these new developments? And again, being a community researcher, I spent a lot of time there. I literally, I was able to get a sabbatical to start doing this research. And so during my sabbatical, I was there every single day for several hours a day just to get to know the people that work there and the youth. And through that time that I spent there, more than the arena development was affecting youth, what really stood out to me was I was meeting people that were maybe 21, 22, and they had been houseless for 3, 4, 5 years already. Or speaking with youth workers that would say that a lot of the youth that they work with, their parents were homeless before that, right? And so what I started to see was, or get a better understanding was just this perpetual cycle of houselessness that just keeps going and going. And in doing my background research and in trying to learn about the issue in from a Canadian context, reading papers that were written in the 90s or in the 80s that would say, we need to change how we do things, right? And we're still saying we need to change how we do things. And so through this work, I was able to start to uncover and make those connections, not just with, people's individual circumstances, but really the systemic issues that are creating those conditions that lead to poverty and houselessness, right? And that continue to perpetuate that cycle. And so that's where my research went, was not just to tell the stories and shine a light on the issues, but to really uncover and make those connections between, neoliberal capitalist ideals and settler colonialism and how they just are continually perpetuating that vicious circle that we see day in and day out and was illuminated, in Edmonton when a group of houseless people were kicked out of the LRT station because we're implementing the rules, right? So that's kind of where I started with this work, and now I'm working more on the preventive aspect. So I'm working with Indigenous organizations to look at a group of youth that are going to be housed in an Indigenous-led housing development and reconnecting those youth back to their culture and to ceremony and embedding them in their community, and to follow that and to show how that's probably going to be a much more successful way of housing Indigenous youth.
Okay. So two questions right off the bat. One of the things that I've learned in the course of the show is that the words that we use very much do matter. And particularly when we're using words to describe situations or demographic groups, you appear to be using the word houselessness very deliberately, and more so than homelessness. May I ask why that is?
Yeah, and I'll say that's a re-education for me as well. Very often, we moved away from saying they are homeless to saying they are experiencing homelessness. And before I talk about that, the change to the word houseless, is the most important thing is to ask people how do they describe themselves? And I'll tell you, if you stop and talk to someone on the street or who doesn't have shelter, they probably might not call themselves either, to be perfectly honest. Because the question I would ask youth, do you consider yourself homeless? And a lot of times they're like, no, I'm staying at my buddy's house, right? So it's really important to actually talk to people and ask them, and we use these labels. But where the movement on going away from homeless to houseless is that if you also take the time and speak to people that might be living in an encampment or on the street or something like that, they actually have a home. That's their home, right? Like, they have community. And so it's a house, it's a shelter that they're a shelter in the Western colonial ideal, right? And one of the best educations I had was listening to Blake Desjarlais, who just recently spoke about the issue because his cousin passed away, or he talked about the story of his cousin passing away. And he said, Indigenous peoples, the land is our home, right? And so being on the land, that doesn't mean that we're homeless. And that's actually an interesting thing when you talk about a definition of Indigenous homelessness, because a lot of people love to say, non-Indigenous people love to say, like, let's just build a whole bunch of homes and that'll solve the problem, and we'll just give a percentage to the Indigenous peoples, right? But the definition of Indigenous homelessness, and you can, Jesse Thistle came up with this definition, was not just a lack of shelter, but is a lack of connection to the land and lack of connection to culture and to community, right? And so there is more to just having shelter, not just for Indigenous peoples, but for everyone that is in this situation. And so I believe that's where this move to go to houseless as opposed to homeless, because for a lot of people, that is their home, being on the street. And then we wonder why they might not want to go to a shelter, or why it's harder to get them, to give them keys to an apartment and everything's going to change, right? No, you're taking them away possibly from that community. And it's so much more complex than just giving people the keys to a house. Yes, that will solve a lot of issues, but there needs to be more than just a roof over someone's head to deal with the issues that we're talking about.
It seems like I was listening to another person speak earlier this week, and it seems like the one thing that we're moderately, probably not even moderately, good at when it comes to trying to address houselessness. I'm going to try to use that word for the rest of this interview. I will screw up, and I apologize in advance.
I do too. So, right.
It seems like we're pretty good at the first step, whatever that first step is. I mean, Calgary has what I've heard described as the largest homeless shelter in North America, and it seems like we do the first thing to kind of make the problem go away, but it's only the first step in what should perhaps be a long series of steps. Do you think that's a fair categorization or characterization?
I mean, I would say we still have to do a lot more in that first step. if that first step is giving people shelter, Sure, we've got a lot of emergency shelters. There still isn't enough room for the amount of people that need that emergency shelter, especially now during COVID, because capacity rates have significantly decreased. Like I'll tell you, in Edmonton at Boyle Street, when we would have cold snaps like we did the last couple of weeks, they would see between 300 to 500 people in their drop-in shelter, right, in a day. This is not a space that can really, and so that's a drop-in shelter, right? It's not an overnight. But even the overnight shelters, right? There is so much space that you can have for the amount of people that need the problem. So there's the emergency part, which a lot of people are saying or advocating we need to move away from that. Like we obviously need to take care of those that are in crisis, but we need to really start to find more permanent supportive housing, or even it's called rapid rehousing, right? Like when someone, especially right now, it's going to be happening a lot. People might be getting evicted because they can't afford their rent. So how do we rapidly rehouse them, right? Whether it's in a temporary location, and I will say there has been some really good work because of COVID, looking at that kind of model, whether it be hotels or those kinds of things. So that's happening, but that's like a band-aid, right? Like and even creating more permanent supportive housing, that this is great. But then yeah, that's that first step. But what we really need to look at is what's causing the problem in the first place, right? So you are a paramedic. You probably see people that have chronic diseases like cardiovascular disease. And I'm sure you would love to see a lot fewer people getting cardiovascular disease if we took preventive measures to decrease the cardiovascular disease, right? The same thing with the houseless community. A lot of people are houseless when they didn't have to be because of these systems that just create the conditions that lead them to lose their houses, right?
Okay.
So.
So you've kind of touched on a couple of different underlying causes of houselessness. What has your research shown you, or sort of the what are the common threads, or what are the biggest causes? And I realize I'm asking for a gross oversimplification of an incredibly complex problem, but if you had to put a couple of major themes out there, being very, very clear that these are not the only themes. What are we kind of looking at?
Poverty, right? Can't afford to pay rent, can't afford to buy a house, you're not gonna have shelter, right? And what causes poverty? Low minimum wage, cutting income support like AISH. That's it's poverty, but then it's that there's the systemic part, right? So we're cutting all these supports, or we don't pay people enough for work that is not deemed, oh, now we call it essential and worthy. But up until COVID, was taking care of the elderly in a nursing home considered a high priority job, or taking care of young children in daycare? Is that considered a job that we should be paying barely above minimum wage? Because there's minimum wage and then there's a living wage, right? A lot of $15 an hour is for most people not going to be enough to pay the average rent in Calgary or Edmonton, let's say. There's one thing like poverty that is perpetuated by, again, not paying people enough for the work that they do, or a lot of that work is precarious, right? Where you're working maybe 10 hours here, 10 hours there. When I talked about youth workers told me that sometimes a lot of people that are experienced that were are houseless probably grew up in an experience where they might have intermittently had to be on the streets or whatever it is. And another risk factor for houselessness in young people is having been in the foster care system, right? Because what happens is you enter the foster care system, and some places are amazing and families and do really good work, but a lot of times You know, depending on the youth and depending on where they're placed, they're not learning the basic skills of money management, taking care of themselves once they're out of the system, and then they just get released, right? Yeah, sure, they probably have caseworkers and that kind of thing, but that's a huge risk factor for becoming houseless once you age out of the system. Well, why do some of these kids enter the system? It's because of poverty, right? Because a lot of people assume it's, oh, violence and this and that. And I'm not denying that that doesn't happen, right? But a lot of times children are apprehended because their parents, often a single mother, can't afford to pay rent. And so I have had youth workers tell me, young women are told, you know, if you just put your kid in the system, then you can enter a shelter because you can't go to shelter with a young child. And then your kid will be housed in the system. And now you've entered that system. So there's that other perpetuation, right? Because being in the system increases your risk of being houseless once you age out. But you entered the system because your mom couldn't afford to pay rent. And so she was going to be kept late, right? It's just constant. It keeps going and going and going, right? Poverty is a huge one, right? And another big one is for that perpetual cycle, it is just the we talk about cracks in the system, but it's really the way the system is managed. Like, you don't have conversations between different agencies. Like, the justice system doesn't work closely with the housing sector. So you know, a young person might become incarcerated, right? Because when you end up on the street, you might have, you know, engage in behaviors that are deemed illegal, or, you know, panhandling is illegal in places. Or you had to steal some food, and now you end up in remand center or something like that, right? Well, what happens when you get released from the remand center, right? Are they calling a social worker to come get you, or are they, you know, letting you call your family or whatever? That, no, they just get released. And so now you're back on the street again, right? Like, that's for now, amazing agencies like the people at Boyle Street and other agencies around the province, they work really hard to connect with those youth to try and get them that support. But it's not coordinated, right? It's a non-for-profit agency is sending social workers to correction systems to work with the youth that are there, but it's not coordinated, right? So there's so many more, but I'm going to say, like, the poverty one for me is a big one, because it would definitely improve a lot of people's outcomes if we worked really hard to actually eliminate poverty and not just say that we're eliminating poverty or trying to, right?
With the poverty conversation, one of the things that's always struck me as I'm going to go ahead and use the word fascinating, is the fact that it seems like to me, and I see this not only in just my day-to-day conversations with people, but certainly through the work that I do that's not associated with this, where, you know, I saw there's a homelessness advocate in Calgary named Chaz Smith. And he has a foundation called Be the Change YYC. We did an interview with him probably about a year ago, and I saw him presenting to city council just recently, and he was breaking down the numbers of how much does it cost to effectively keep a homeless or a houseless person homeless or houseless versus how much would it cost to make them safe. And I'm understating it by saying it's orders of magnitudes in difference of cost. So if we were to just make people safe, or help people get safe is probably a better way to say it, we would be saving our system tremendous amounts of money as opposed to what we spend right now keeping them in the system, or helping them to stay in the system, or however we want to phrase it. And yet that argument just doesn't seem to resonate with people. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. So first of all, yeah. And I don't know, I can't give you a specific statistics or a statistic statistic or number, but absolutely you're going to be decreasing the cost, because as a paramedic, you see the people, especially when it's as cold as it was. A lot of them need, you know, crisis intervention. They need that, like frostbite, all those kinds of things, right? And that's just when it's that's cold, but there's so many other issues. Like, they have higher risk of cardiovascular disease. If they're at risk of cancer, are they getting screened? No. Right. So many things that would help decrease costs. You know, the organization I'm working with right now, they have a place in Edmonton called Ambrose Place, and it is permanent supportive housing building for Indigenous peoples. That not only are they providing that permanent support in terms of helping them with their addiction, managed alcohol program, all those kinds of things, but also surrounding them with the cultural supports that they need. Well, they've shown significantly reduced need for calling ambulances, for bringing them to the emergency care, decreased interventions with Edmonton police, right? So yeah, there's a lot of there is research that shows it decreases the cost, but why? Just look at what happened in Edmonton last week with people that are houseless, and look at what happened yesterday in Edmonton with a anti-mask, basically white supremacist protest. And were those people pushed out of the way and told where to go? Like, yeah, one guy was arrested, right? Whereas the houseless people were kicked out and shown the door and said, yeah, you are not worth being taken care of right now, right? So there is an ideal that a lot of people have, and a lot of people that might be in leadership roles in this province, that, you know, that whole pull yourself up by the bootstraps, right? Like, you need to work hard, and success comes from working hard and pushing through things and that kind of thing. And so if you can't do that, so, and if then there's something wrong with your moral character, right? Like, you are not as good as that person who is successful, even though that success probably happened not because of that person's own work without support from a lot of different people, right? And so I really think that we just don't think that people that are in these circumstances, or one of the reasons why we don't support people in these circumstances systemically, is because we have this meritocracy that you need to work hard to be successful. And, you know, if you're poor, there's something wrong with you. And, you know, why should we throw money at you? Because you're just going to go buy cheesies. And what did they say about CERB?
It was cheesies and Netflix, I think it was.
Right? Like, that exemplifies the attitude towards people living in poverty. Or I'm not going to give $10 to the person panhandling on the street because they're just going to go, you know, use drugs. One, who cares? Like, who cares if they're just going to use drugs? Because honestly, when you're on the street, sometimes from a harm reduction approach, that, you know, might be what's keeping you alive that day, because you're so depressed or whatever, you're having such difficulty on the street. Or chances are, no, they'll probably just get something to eat if they're allowed to actually enter somewhere to get food. Right. So that's that attitude, that lesser than attitude of people that are in these circumstances, or they must have done something to lead them to be in that place. So does that kind of answer that question? That's why I think because the whole argument for harm reduction sites, there is a huge fiscal argument.
Oh, for sure.
Right?
Like, there's no question.
Still not funding it. Why? Moral, there's some sort of something wrong with your moral character if you're taking drugs.
So, well, it's
the same argument.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because, I think it presupposes that the causes of houselessness are all the same, and that's simply not true. I mean, I've certainly met people. Everybody's got a different story, and that's why I was trying to kind of hedge. What are the causes of homelessness? Because there's so many and they're so varied, but I come across people on a regular basis who have PhDs. I come across people on a regular basis who have worked in other parts of the world with incredible resumes. And I come across with people who have mental illness, and I come across people who have generational trauma. And the thing that I personally struggle with is the notion that that whole pull yourself up from your bootstraps. Well, for some of these people, the distance that they have to pull to do that, if it was even possible, is almost incalculable. But the other problem that I have with that is some of these people just don't have bootstraps.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Aaron Paquette in Edmonton, just right after that, he said they don't even have boots.
Yeah.
He can't. And the reason they don't have boots is because, you know, we took their parents and grandparents away, 50 to 100, 200 years ago and put them in residential schools and created intergenerational trauma because of it, right? There's so many things that, it's just this whole thought that success only comes from personal drive and personal, I don't even know the word, but through your own doing. Like, no one who is successful got there by themselves. No one.
And it's the work ethic piece, like the idea that they're not working hard. That has always been one that I've really had a challenge with, because I would be willing to bet that most of the people who advocate for, well, if you just worked a little bit harder, have no appreciation for how much work and effort it is to survive on the street, let alone get off of the street. So it's a bit of a disingenuous.
Well, absolutely. There's that. And I always will say to people, why don't you go and, get cans through dumpsters and ask people on the street for cans and ask people for money and see how hard that is and how much money you end up getting from it.
Right? Yeah.
And that's, you know, it's interesting. Like the research that I do, that type, we call that work. That's people's work. Work is anything a person does to stay alive and to be human. And that is work. Finding shelter is work, and it's hard. And on top of it's hard to stay alive, the discrimination and the stigma that is placed on them and how people are treated, like not even allowed to use a bathroom in places, right? Like, and so it's just this whole combination of things. Is it simplifying by saying poverty is the main cause? It is, because you definitely have people that were of means that ended up homeless, but the majority of people that you're seeing are people that lived in poverty as young people or are living in poverty, especially in Edmonton, probably Calgary too. A big proportion of the people that are houseless are Indigenous, right? And why is that? Because again, that Indigenous homelessness definition, lack of connection to culture, to ceremony, to the land, like all these things that are stripped away from the Indigenous peoples, and not to mention the discrimination of settler colonialism and all those kinds of things, right? Like it's just a big, it's all interwound, right? So because what's another risk factor for becoming houseless? Entering this, entering the child welfare system. Well, who is disproportionately represented in the child welfare system? Right? Indigenous peoples. In the project I'm working with right now, where we're looking at housing young people that are coming out of the system in an Indigenous led organization, you know, many people, elders that I've spoken with or other Indigenous peoples will be like, why don't you stop taking our children away from us in the first place? Right? Like we absolutely mm-hmm. have to do that as well. And I know that there's work on doing that, but we're still not doing it enough, right? Because the people that are in the system that are apprehending children, most of them are not Indigenous and have this, again, Western colonial view of how you need to bring up your children. The way that some families are doing it may not be deemed worthy or done, they're doing it right. And so children get apprehended, or they're living in poverty, they get apprehended. And if they're apprehended, are they trying to put them in a kinship care? I know they're definitely working more and more to try and do that, but that has to happen more, right? Because that disconnect from culture is such a big factor for Indigenous people. So yeah, like it is, it's very complex and there's a massive web, but for me, that poverty piece, that's one thing that, systemically we can work on. But again, we're cutting age, we're cutting supports to people that aged out of the system. The supports were from 18 to 24. Now they're getting cut back to 22. Right. Like there was a story of a woman in I think she was from Edmonton, and she challenged it, like it went to court to challenge that. There was an injunction and sadly it failed. She was saying, well, so now instead of going to school, I'm probably going to have to go back to work. And I think it was possibly, either working in sex trade or stripping. I can't remember what it was. And she's like, well, because of that, then what's going to happen to her child? Right. And so there you're perpetuating that cycle again. Right. Yeah. Because you've cut supports for 2 years. So, and it's just, it just keeps going around and around.
What would you, and again, I realize I'm asking you to paint with an incredibly broad brush, but if there were three government policies, and I want to be clear, I'm not making it specific to any given political party, because we certainly saw an interesting announcement from the NDP last
night.
Yes,
we did.
I did not see that one coming for our listeners. Just for a little bit of context, it was last night. We're recording this on February 21st, and it was last night that Rachel Notley came out and said that the NDP on a provincial level would not at this time be pursuing a universal basic income, which a lot of people sort of went, wait, what? And raises a whole bunch of questions. But so I think there's a safe argument to be made that there's a lot of political parties that do not understand the breadth and depth of the complexity of the issue. But what would you say are sort of the currently active three most harmful things that you see governments doing to perpetuate houselessness?
Oh, so I can't talk about UBI? No.
We can.
It's all the policies that are leading to decreasing supports to people that need them to stay alive, to keep their houses. So again, let's not cut AISH. Let's not make it more difficult to be eligible for AISH, because they're moving towards reevaluating who's going to get AISH. And it sounds like if you don't have a visible disability, then you're not going to qualify, right? And if we look at let's bring back minimum wage for young people to $15 at least, because there's this attitude that, because it got cut to 13, this attitude that, oh, well, young people, they're just like supplementing so that they can buy an iPhone and things like that. Well, there's actually a lot of young people that are instrumental in bringing income to their families so that they don't lose their homes. Right. So, let's not cut AISH. let's increase the funding to AISH. Let's bring back at least a $15 an hour minimum wage for people under 18. I can't remember where I was going to go with that. It's these are the small things that can be done that, it's that you're a paycheck away from losing your home. Oh, here's one that I wanted to talk about. One of the things that also increases the difficulty for people getting homes, houses, whether it's through rental or mainly rental, but also buying houses, is the cost of rents and the cost of houses that has skyrocketed in the last 15 to 20 years. And there's a phenomenon called the financialization or commodification of housing. So we should be treating housing as a human right, just like healthcare is a human right. We don't treat it as a human right in North America. We treat it as a commodity. And how are we treating it as a commodity? Well, there is a bunch of multinational corporations that actually come in to different jurisdictions and buy up lots of housing complexes, or they start to build housing complexes. And these are organizations that are publicly traded, right? So we literally housing is a commodity, right? And when that happens, the rents of those places go up dramatically, even in places like Sweden, where it's like, you know, pretty socialist, we're taking care of everyone, huge social safety net. It's happening even in Sweden, where like a group called Blackstone, I believe, just basically came in and bought a bunch of formerly social housing units and now have turned them into condos, and rents have skyrocketed. And not only for those centers, for those buildings, but also for the places around them. And when that happens, and property taxes go up and those kinds of things. So what are other government policies, even from a municipal level, is to decrease the amount of organizations that can come in and start to sweep up different housing units and rack up the prices of rents. Because there is a significant problem in all of North America, but in Edmonton, for example, there's probably around 1,500 to 2,000 empty units in Edmonton. And there's over 2,000 people looking for homes, right? But they can't afford those units because they're too expensive. So that's a big problem, right? Is the affordability of housing. And if we can find ways to, and I know the cities are saying we're looking at affordable housing initiatives, and that's great. But so we need policies to make housing more affordable, to make it more accessible. And we also need, beyond policies, we need society to not lose their minds when the city wants to build an affordable housing unit in your backyard, because that also happens, right? Mm-hmm. People hear affordable housing and they're like, those people. I want those people to come. Because I don't know what people think when they hear the word affordable housing. Not sure what they envision, but it's really often it might be someone, a recent university grad that cannot buy a house. So I'm rambling, but that's a big one. Like there's the systemic part of we need to not cut income supports and those kinds of things, but there's also that affordability of housing that is a huge issue that makes it difficult. Even when we like these housing first programs that have you know, been somewhat successful in getting people housed, they basically are supported, like they're subsidized for around a year. But then after that year, you basically have to pay market housing. Well, depending on what's happened in a year, if you were formerly houseless and depending for how long, in a year, are you going to be able to get to a point where you have to pay like $1,500 to $2,000 a month for rent?
Especially during a time of a global pandemic, for example.
Right. Right. So there's, yeah, it's on so many levels. I could just.
it seems like one of the biggest obstacles, unfortunately, is the perceptual piece. We certainly saw this with the supervised consumption sites here in Calgary, where because there was a supervised consumption site near the Sheldon Schumer, people started to pay more attention to what was going on near the Sheldon Schumer. And despite the fact that a lot of the crime rates actually went down, and there were fewer ambulances being called out for overdoses, and the amount of needles that supervised consumption sites take in versus what they hand out creates a net negative number of needles on the street. There was still that perception of, oh, but they're gross and scary. The thing that's always struck me is when we're talking about opiate users, they're some of the least threatening folks out there because they're sleepy most of the time. but have you done any research into sort of how to accomplish a perceptual shift in society? Are you aware of any research for how to accomplish? Because that seems to be the biggest barrier, is that we can have some amazing ideas for programs, we can have amazing ideas and research for ways to address homelessness, houselessness, but until we get the political will in place to say, no, we're going to do this. And B, we get the perceptual shift in the public. It's very difficult for any of those incredibly well-informed, researched, evidence-based things to actually go into practice.
Yeah. I'm personally, we plan on doing that with this Indigenous Housing Initiative because it's smack dab in the middle of a neighborhood in Edmonton, right? So that's one thing that we hope to do in a year or two is have those conversations. But I do know the same organization that I'm working with that they opened Ambrose Place. So Ambrose Place is just in the east part of downtown. You know, the part of downtown that has most of the homeless shelters and drop-in centers and those kinds of things. And so their perception when they were about to open for that place was like, again, not in my backyard. What are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. But that organization did an excellent job of outreach, of talking to people in the community. There were still people that didn't want them there. But as they started to see, it was like, oh, there's actually less problems happening right now because they actually are being taken care of and they're not on the street, right? That definitely started to change. So yeah, there needs to be more outreach. I do think there has been somewhat of a shift, at least from what I know in Edmonton, from that moving away from that NIMBYism. Like there actually have been several affordable housing initiatives, and I'm not sure if they're permanent supportive because those are quite different. But in neighborhoods like, you know, within outside of the downtown core, you know, or the more affluent neighborhoods, if you want to call it that, where those initiatives actually have been announced and people didn't go get the hell out of here. So they're moving forward. So I do think there is somewhat of a shift happening, but we need to continue that shift. And you know, we need to educate young people that are houseless are not dangerous, that they're just in a circumstance right at this point in time. And, you know, I tell people when someone, like, if you donate money to whatever charity that serves people experiencing homelessness or that are houseless, but then when someone on the street asks you for money and you turn your head or you ignore them and walk away, like, what good is that money that you donated if you're not treating that person that you just saw as a human being? So I also tell people, just stop. If you don't, like, you don't have to give money, you might not have money to give, but just stop and say, you know what, I don't have anything to give you, but I hope you have a really good day. You know, see you later. That does the world to humanize the person that you just in the past maybe would have ignored, right? So as a society, we just need to humanize people. Like we don't want to see them. They make us uncomfortable and we have to stop that. So I haven't done any research and I haven't done enough reading to see. I'm sure there is research on this topic, but we definitely need to do that. We need to educate society on the fact that first, someone that's on the street isn't going to be dangerous 99.9% of the time. Two, affordable housing in your neighborhood isn't going to change the dynamics of your neighborhood.
Well, it's fascinating. The whole not in my backyard aspect has always been fascinating to me because in my work, I get to go into people's houses in a variety of neighborhoods. And if you live in a nice neighborhood, and you don't think that there are horrifying things going on in your neighborhood, that you're wrong. Like that's all there is to it. Some of the most jarring houses that I've walked into have been in some of the nicest neighborhoods in Calgary. So there's a huge disconnect between the reality of what I'll use the term real life is. And what any individual person is experiencing.
And also, what's a good home? Like, it's a very, again, Western single family home ideal. Like, this whole thing, like, that you've succeeded when you've bought yourself a house. Like, what is wrong with renting? Like, who cares? Like, yeah. And I know that's shifting. Like, with young people, you see that. Like, it's shifting just because it's so damn expensive to buy a home, right? So yeah, like there's this whole perception that you've of moral failing if you can't afford to buy a house, and success happens only when you've bought your own home, right? Mm-hmm. Like it's crazy. You know, I wanted to go back when I was talking about that financialization of housing and connect it to UBI. I'm very curious, that report that was mentioned by Rachel Notley is now publicly available, and I want to go through it before I comment on they're crazy. UBI is good. Because who knows? I don't know what that report says. I want to see what they're talking about. I mean, what I know of in the research that I've done, and I'm a strong advocate of UBI, is the word universal means it has no strings attached, right? It's barrier free, because we're going to give it to everyone, whether you're making 300 grand a year or more to that. And I know people get pissed off all about that, but that's what makes it barrier free. And it makes life a lot easier, because even with CERB, you've got to apply to it, and there's all these rules you have to follow. And then, oh my God, some people screwed up and they weren't eligible, and now they're going to have to pay back 20 grand or something like that, right? Like, it just makes life a lot more complicated and difficult. So when it's universal, it's just here, have it. And then that whole affordability of housing isn't as much of an issue, because you're going to have extra money to be able to pay that rent, to pay that mortgage, or whatever it is, right? So I'm a strong advocate of it, one, because of that universal nature. And the idea is, it's one, you would combine a lot of the social supports like AISH or Alberta Works, so that you can afford to pay it. And then depending on how you manage a universal basic income system, yeah, you're not going to just say, oh, well, everyone's got extra money, so we're going to cut all the social programs. And like, you cut the income supports, right, and combine them. But, you know, a lot of the social programs, we're still going to need permanent supportive housing, all those kinds of things. But it's a lot easier to afford your permanent supportive housing when you've got an income that you know is coming every month, and you don't have to worry about where you're going to get the money to pay your rent, right? So that the whole NDP announcement about that, I'm really confused, but I'm not going to say anything until I've had time to read it. I'm shocked.
It was super, like, just to go on a complete tangent here, it was super weird timing to throw that out, yeah, too. Yeah. Because, I mean, the bottom line, looking at the, forgive my language, shit show that yesterday was, we looked at the end of, it was after midnight, who are the provincial leaders who have said something about the Tiki Torch March that took place in Edmonton. And she was the only one.
Yeah.
And so from a communication standpoint, there's so much opportunity to pick up some yardage there.
Yeah.
And to do the statement saying, no, this is bad and racist, and this is bad, and then go, oh, and by the way, we're not doing UBI. I was like, what's just happened here?
And so, yeah, this report says there are other things. So what are those things? Like, don't make not everybody's going to be an academic geek like me and want to dive into the report and see what it says, right? Like, or say, here's an interesting report on UBI. Maybe it's not the answer, but not a blanket. curious. I'm curious.
The other piece to me is one of the struggles that I have with some forms of academia, as he chooses his words carefully, is, you know, the evidence was very strong 20 years ago, 30 years ago, that switching to more green energy was a good idea, and that, you know, electric cars are a good idea. And that managing addiction is not as simple as just say no. But the obstacle seems to always be, okay, yes, there's a better way to do a thing, but can we get there right now? Can we get there in 5 years? Can we get there in 10 years? And I'm sure that there are people who could craft an ideal society where minimal people fall through the cracks, or whatever phrasing that we want to use. But if we look at utopia and we go, well, we can't get there right now, so we're just not going to do the things, anything, that's hugely problematic to me, because I've never seen a UBI occupy as much space in the political conversation as it has over the last year. And to let perfect be the enemy of good is a very strange. I'm looking forward to hearing more as well, is what I'll say.
Well, and you know, it's interesting. The CERB is basically somewhat of a version of a UBI, right? With barriers and its complexities and that kind of thing. And you look at social media and you look at the stories where people are like, oh, it's been extended for another 5. I can't remember the extension now, but people are like, thank God, now I don't have to worry about my rent, right? Like it, and the research that's been done on UBI is like the one that was done in Manitoba in the 70s and, that's been, and, or the experiment that was about to start in Ontario, not that long ago before the Ford government came in and got rid of it. But, you know, people are, again, the perception, oh, they're going to be eating cheesies and watching Netflix or whatever. No, it's people are now not worrying about paying the rent. So now they're back in school, or they're maybe working in a job that doesn't pay as well, but it's a job that serves the community. You know what I mean? Like there's so much evidence that it's that social safety net, which is a determinant of health, right? Like it's not just, because people, when they hear me talk, they think I'm like a social worker or whatever. I'm actually in public health. Like that's what my PhD is in. But all these societal issues impact public health. Like I always tell people, homelessness is the pandemic within a pandemic. Like it is not just impacting people not having shelter, but it impacts the health not at just an individual level, but at a societal level, right? So
there's the derision towards CERB is something that I have not been able to wrap my head around, other than it's just lazy to dislike it, because what people seem to forget is that not everybody got CERB. And the argument that, oh, it's all the drug users or the homeless people went to go get more drugs. They didn't get it. You had to be working for a certain amount of time in order to be eligible for CERB. So the notion that it was the laziest of the lazy who got CERB is profoundly inaccurate.
And anyone on AISH who got CERB got their AISH cut.
Yeah.
I don't pretend to get it. We have some, I'm going to break one of my rules here, because I think that this is important enough to do it. There are some municipal elections coming up. And I don't think that there's any question that there are multiple levels of government that can work to address houselessness and the causes of houselessness. What would you like to say to the many people who are currently running or looking at running for a spot in municipal politics in regards to the houseless situation in Alberta?
I would, obviously, if it's not on anyone's platform, then we shouldn't be even thinking about voting for anyone that isn't thinking about this issue. And I think, you know, it's difficult because you only have so much power from a municipal level to deal with the situation, because a lot of the issues are either from a provincial or federal perspective. But, if people that are running start to think about the issue as treating housing as a human right, and what do we need to do to treat housing as a human right, and taking that human rights perspective to municipal policies. So if we're creating policies, is this going to impact the ability for people to get housing? Is it going to make housing more difficult? So again, are we allowing multinational corporations to come into the city and buy up city lots to create, housing that is not going to be affordable? So it's a bit of a shift, because we keep talking about let's build more houses, but we really need to have that human rights approach to how we look at housing. And that should govern policy. And that's difficult because It means that instead of saying yes to corporations that might be bringing lots of money to your municipal coffers, you might have to say no to them, right? Or it might mean that, and I respect the city of Edmonton. I'm not sure what happened in Calgary. They took a no increase in property taxes approach, which is great. Mm-hmm. If it was at the cost of or of programs that then might impact people, those that are houseless, then that's a different story, right? So it is. It's and I'm not I'm not a municipal or a politician. I don't ever plan on being, even though a lot of people think I should. I have no desire to do that. I'm happy to work in the background and help inform policy. I fully understand the complexities that you don't just have to think about housing when you run a city. But if there's a way to bring that rights approach to the way we deal with housing, if there's a way that we can coordinate the system, there's an approach called a duty to assist approach that's been adopted in like Wales is the biggest one that they've done it, where basically you have a duty to assist those that are experiencing homelessness or those that are houseless. And the idea is to have that coordination across sectors so that you work with the schools and the municipal government and you work with the homeless serving organizations and those kinds of things. So trying to coordinate that, have a coordinated approach, I think is important. I know we're like people are getting there, but a lot of times it comes from the not-for-profits who understand the importance of that coordinated approach. And that isn't how we should be doing things. Not-for-profits should not be tasked with coming up with policy solutions because they've got more than enough work to do. But yeah, if there are people looking to get into municipal leadership and again, that rights-based approach and looking at coordinated access for people, then that's a start because it's that lack of coordination that also leads to those gaps in the system.
Okay. Is there anything else? I have one more thing I want to talk about real quick, but before we do that, is there anything else that you'd like people to hear or you'd like people to know?
I think a big first step, yeah, we got to change the system and we've got to do a lot of things, but part of that, people aren't going to push politicians and they're not going to push the system if they don't deem the people that we're talking about worthy. And so humanizing people that are houseless, humanizing the people that you see on the street that are asking you for some money. You know, like I always say, stop and say hello. You don't have to give them anything, but just giving them a smile and talking to them is a first step. Like, is that going to answer all their problems? Not even remotely, but that's a first step to humanizing people that are houseless. Don't tell your children to be afraid of someone who is panhandling. Explain to them that right now that person, that's the only way that they can get money and that's why they're doing this and humanize them. So I don't know if you're going to go with that. Ask me about that photo that I told you about. If not, I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, I do want to talk about that. Because
so for our listeners and viewers, in the preamble to starting the official podcast, Dr. Perdue showed me a pretty powerful photo, and I'll put it up on the screen for our viewers. But Dr. Perdue, if you could talk a little bit about what this photo is and how it was taken.
So first I need to give credit to who took the photo. Her name is Vicky Lynn Moses, and she's one of the young people that I've worked really closely with who was accessing services at Boyle Street and had been houseless for periods of time. She's housed and she's doing well right now, and she's doing really great, and I'm very proud of her for all the work she does because she's quite a strong advocate for the houseless community. But so she took this photo, and it is such a drastic reminder of how, even though we want to brush poverty aside and just not think about it, it is literally everywhere and in our backyards. And this is such a stark contrast because in Edmonton, Rogers Place, the brand new shiny NHL arena, is literally across the street, like literally, and you'll see that in this photo, from one of the drop-in centers in Edmonton, Boyle Street Community Services, that serves a very large proportion of houseless individuals in Edmonton. And you can literally draw a line in that photo that shows prosperity and poverty across the street. And an interesting thing that happens is back in the day when we were allowed to go to events at Rogers Place, there's the way that people are encouraged to go to enter that building is always in a way that they don't see the people that are across the street. And the people that are across the street, if they try and get close during a game, they're told to move along. We don't need you here. So there's an interesting thing that happens in terms of that displacement. And Boyle Street has been there for over 20 years, maybe even 25 now, in that site. So they were there long before any NHL arena has been there, but yet we keep pushing them away when there's arena events because we just, again, don't want to make people uncomfortable and see people that are experiencing poverty. So
yeah, it's a powerful picture. It's
a powerful picture, and it's interesting to me because one of the most I'm going to go with accommodating, and that is almost certainly the wrong word, shelters in Calgary is a shelter called Alpha House, and it is also right across the street from the Stampede grounds and less than a quarter block away from the main, one of the main entrances that people use, not only to go to all of the games that happen there, but also for all of the Stampede events. And so it's striking that we have such abject poverty in the same place as the complete opposite.
And we shouldn't.
I can't think of a better line to end it on than that. So I just want to thank you again, Dr. Perdue, for being as generous with your time as you have been. This is a hugely important issue, and I'm a subscriber to the idea that the measurement of any society is how they treat their most vulnerable. And if we apply that meter stick to where we are right now, oh boy, do we have work to do.
We have a lot of work to do, but let's look at the positive and work on that prevention. And again, let's treat everyone as human beings and push our government to care for them as we would like to be cared for. So.
Awesome. Thanks. You again.
And that's it for another episode of The Breakdown. As always, if you appreciate the kind of content that we're trying to produce here, please consider signing up to be one of our Patreon supporters at our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/thebreakdownab. And if you're listening to the audio version of our podcast, please consider leaving a rating and review, because it's those ratings and reviews that help us get the podcast in front of more people and into more ears. Thank you again for your time.